appellant in this case, Nicholas Little. And I'd like to begin today by addressing the trial court's failure to conduct an evidentiary hearing as to whether Mr. Little made a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of his right to testify. Mr. Little had a constitutional right to testify at his trial, and he fully expected to exercise that right. This is evidenced both by Mr. Little's subsequent affidavit as part of his motion for an evidentiary hearing, and by his counsel's representation to the court that Mr. Little would, in fact, be testifying. However, on the night before the defense rested, Mr. Little had a number of alcoholic drinks. He arrived in court the next day, and both his defense attorney and one of the prosecutors smelled an odor of alcohol on him. He had an exchange with his attorney about whether he would be permitted to testify. And as Mr. Little describes it, his attorney informed him he could not put him on the stand because the jury might smell an odor of alcohol and think he was drunk, or the court might smell it and find him in contempt and revoke his bond. Mr. Little's attorney provided an affidavit that acknowledged that he had informed Mr. Little that he couldn't put him on the stand, that Mr. Little did smell of alcohol, and that he never offered him any other option, such as continuing the case so that he could testify on a different day. This evidence, these were specific, credible allegations under Robertson, and this evidence was enough to trigger an evidentiary hearing.
Well, so we have, I think, an agreement that the facts are essentially as you described, and this was put forth before the trial judge, correct?
We have an agreement that these were the facts that were put forth
yes.
in front of the trial judge.
Yes. But I
do not agree that these would have been the only facts that would have come out had there been an evidentiary hearing.
Sure, but with respect to the question that is before us, there's really no substantial dispute that the facts are as represented
yes,
in
think,
the declaration.
Yes, I think that's correct.
And the trial court had this, and
yes.
then the trial court made a determination which is subject to an abuse of discretion standard, correct?
Well, I don't know that it's subject to an abuse of
what is the
standard.
Appropriate?
I would submit that the appropriate standard is to know
why,
because we're not the court. This court is not in a position now where it has to weigh credibility. There was no testimony presented because there was no evidentiary hearing. I mean, that's exactly what Mr. Little was asking for, that opportunity.
And what case do you rely on for that standard of review?
Well, I don't know that a case has said that there's an abuse of discretion either.
No, that's not my question. My question
yes,
is.
I know. But I do think that certainly there is precedent for this idea that when you don't, I mean, certainly I think it's well established in our case law that when you don't have to weigh issues of credibility, you're not looking at an abuse of discretion standard. This court sits in the same position, which is the standard, as the trial court when it's looking at these affidavits, when it's looking at Mr. Little's motion. So this court is free because it's not constrained by other observations the trial court could have made had there been something like live testimony, because right here we have it just on paper, what everybody said and what was represented and then the motions before the court. And this obviously is what is at stake here are significant constitutional rights. We're talking about a defendant's right to testify and waiving that right knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily, and whether or not that has actually occurred. And we're looking at that through the framework of IAC.
What do you contend would have come out at an evidentiary hearing that was not before the judge at the time he or she made the determination there would be no evidentiary hearing?
Well, I think what is evident from the record that could have been brought forth at the evidentiary hearing and was not present is what exactly transpired, what trial counsel would represent transpired between him and Mr. Little. Mr. Little provided a detailed affidavit explaining what he believed, what he thought would happen, and what his attorney was saying to him. And his attorney, in response, provided a somewhat vague affidavit that did acknowledge certain factors that supported Mr. Little's account of what transpired between them. most notably the fact that he says he instructed his client, I cannot put you on the stand. Now, he suggests in his affidavit that perhaps he thought Mr. Little understood that to mean something different than what Mr. Little is suggesting. He suggested maybe that had to do with preparation. But he doesn't actually talk about it. And that's why an evidentiary hearing would be so important.
I've got a question about the standard of knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver with regard to testifying. So the defendant has a right to testify, and a defendant has a right not to testify. Suppose you are appointed to represent one of the Bundys from Nevada, and they view you as simply a function of the oppressive government who's there to get in their way, and your client refuses to engage in any conversation with you mm-hmm. whatsoever, hostile or otherwise. Mm-hmm. You impart information. He indicates that he understands it, but doesn't give you any particular instruction. He's not hostile. He's just disdainful. Mm-hmm. You go to trial. The state puts on its evidence. Do you have an obligation to call him, or do you have an obligation not to call him as a witness?
Well, I think the difficulty there is you're indicating that there was no communication. You're not able to get an understanding of whether or not your client wishes to testify under those circumstances.
Yeah, he's not interested in telling you.
He's not interested in telling
you. And he makes it clear he's not interested in telling any member of the Bar Association.
Well, I guess that would raise several.
Do you call him or do you not call him? I'm interested in this issue. Do you call him or not call him? What's your duty?
Well, I think counsel's duty is to give the defendant the opportunity to take the stand. So whether or not
the defendant exercises
that right.
So
I think there's a number.
When you come back, and you'll have 10 minutes to think mm-hmm. about this, I'm going to ask you more about how exactly that would play out in the courtroom with the jury watching.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Don Porter, Senior Deputy Prosecutor for King County, representing the state in this matter. The appellant raised 5 separate and distinct legal claims on appeal. I believe all of them are heavily fact-dependent, heavily fact-driven. I asked for and was granted the opportunity to file an over-length brief so that I could fully explicate all the necessary facts. I don't think they were present in the original briefing by the appellant. I just want to let you know that I'm prepared to address any of these 5 major legal claims.
Well, why don't we focus on what appellant has? And one of my questions is, okay, what's our review standard?
I think it has to be abuse of discretion because of the fact-finding nature that the trial court engaged in. There was a frustrating lack of direct precedent on this type of circumstance. But I think all of the other situations involving such a clear fact-finding apply the abuse of discretion standard. But I think the main point in this is that the appellant, the defendant in making these claims, has to overcome the presumption that he chose not to testify based on advice of counsel. And he has to prove that by a preponderance of the evidence just to get a full evidentiary hearing. And he can't do that in this case. In this case, I think you recognize from the record and from my briefing that we have the unusual circumstance. As you know, this is not one of the rights that we require colloquy. We don't require the defendant to make a knowing, intelligent waiver of his right to testify on the record. But in this case, I think it's safe to say the prosecutor, smelled a rat, and he asked the court to engage in a colloquy with the defendant. The prosecutor said, I don't want him coming back and saying, I wanted to testify, but my attorney wouldn't let me. And then the judge addressed the attorney, and Little's attorney said his client understood that he had, quote, an absolute right to testify and an absolute right to not testify. That's at 17 RP 83 to 84. moments later, the court addressed the defendant personally and had Mr. Little acknowledge that he knew that he had an absolute right to testify and an absolute right not to testify. So how does he overcome the presumption, given this circumstance, that we have that on the record? Yeah, I think most of what was presented is frankly noise. Mr. Little got drunk. He wasn't in jail. He was out on bond. He got drunk the night before. He stunk of gin, apparently, in court. The prosecutor and the defense attorney acknowledged it. That's probably why the prosecutor brought this issue to the court's attention about getting the waiver on the record.
I take it that the portion of the record you just described took place after the incident about alcohol?
It was right at that moment of truth.
Okay.
You know, are they going to call any witnesses? Are they going to call Mr. Little? That's when that colloquy occurred. So, you know, this isn't about whether the defense attorney should have asked for a continuance. Clearly, Mr. Little expressed to him that he didn't want to be brought into custody. He didn't want to have the bond revoked. And that would have likely happened, you know, whether he was asking for a continuance.
Let me ask a question. In a determination between whether it's going to be a bench trial or whether it's going to be a jury trial, there's a default position. Starts out as a jury trial, and if nothing happens, it's a jury trial. Is there a default position with regard to the defendant testifying? If nothing happens, does he testify, or if nothing happens, he doesn't testify? What is there a default position?
A legal default position?
Just the same as the example I gave with jury or non-jury.
The default position is that the presumption is that if he doesn't, it was on advice of counsel. Whether he testifies or not.
Is the default position that whatever he does is what must have been elected?
That is the default position, yes. That's the legal presumption that he has to overcome.
Because there's no way to get subjective certainty without violating a Sixth Amendment right, which is the nature of the conversation between he and his lawyer.
That's right. And I think that's why we don't have the requirement of on-the-record waivers and that sort of possible intrusion into what goes on between counsel and client at that moment of truth. But it does create this presumption that's very hard to overcome, and we don't have the facts here to overcome it.
So the nature of the waiver that's referenced, knowing, intelligent, voluntary, is different from the waiver than how we would look at a waiver of a right to a jury trial, where the defendant would be altering a default expectation.
Yes. Yes, I would agree with that. Yes. So unless the court has any other questions or wants to get into any of the other five major claims, but I really do think they were all fact-dependent, and by providing you with the accurate record citations, I don't think there's a close claim among them. I'd ask the court to affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
One thing I just wanted to note that I didn't say when I stood up initially is that Mr. Little does have a number of family and friends in the audience today that are here to support him. I just wanted to let the court know that. One other thing I want to say in response to the state is that there's this emphasis on what must be shown after an evidentiary hearing. When we're talking about the preponderance of the evidence standard, we're talking about the evidentiary hearing itself, not what it takes to get there. And that's a really important distinction, because here we had very specific allegations that were made, and that is what should have triggered the evidentiary hearing, regardless of then what would have come out. And obviously we don't know that, because the court denied Mr. Little that right. And in terms of Mr. Little understanding his absolute right to testify, that there was this colloquy, understanding that there is a right for defendants to testify and feeling as though he had that right and could exercise it in his case are two very different things. And that is exactly what Robinson is looking at, I think, because when we're talking about, yes, there is this absolute right, except when your attorney has turned to you and said, I cannot put you on the stand. And that is different. And to Judge Dwyer's question about this this tension between what can be done and whether and what is the default. Certainly, I think, you know, in the criminal context, there are competing rights there because a defendant doesn't have to present any evidence at all. At the same time, if the defendant wants to testify, he absolutely has that right to do so. So he has to be given that opportunity. And I think that that's exactly the difficulty here.
Well, what's the nature? I mean, you used the term knowing voluntary intelligent waiver as if it were the same as would be used in a jury trial waiver.
Well, I'm using the same language that our Supreme Court is using.
How do you understand it to be the same? Because the situations are certainly not the same. If there's no default position with regard to whether a defendant testifies or does not testify, then the situation is very different from the jury trial or bench trial.
Well, even if there's not a default position, it remains that the defendant has this right to testify. So even if that could go either way.
Can you exercise your right to testify without knowing intelligently and voluntarily waiving your right not to testify?
The court does not have to engage in that colloquy before
it
takes
that
a stand.
Legal,
correct,
is that legally possible?
Well, I mean,
in your view of
things,
is that legally possible? There's no knowing, intelligent, or voluntary waiver. You just did it.
You exercised your right to testify.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. We would ask that this court remand for an evidentiary hearing, but also rely on our briefing for reversal on all the other issues. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This next matter is State versus